This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
The young shining cuckoo is fed by its foster parents on insects and spiders. But the korimako, or bellbird, has a much more interesting diet of nectar. It's been something of a radio personality and has sung on shortwave radio to Australia and the Pacific nations for 30 years. However, the early recordings failed to reflect the versatility of the bellbird, with its wide variety of liquid notes and artistically placed clicks and bell-like sounds. It's not surprising that Maori mythology describes korimako, the bellbird, as the messenger of Tane, sent to herald the coming of the sun.
Community or chaos, we can construct and nurture community or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society.
Community or Chaos is made possible with the support of Quakers Aotearoa. You'll find them online at quaker.nz.
Good morning, friends. Today we have with us Stephen Zunas, Professor of Middle Eastern Studies and Director of the Department of Middle Eastern Studies at San Francisco University. We'll be talking about the Middle East, also about America, and I'm going to actually do something quite different. I'm going to start with a poem called Don't Mention the Children. It's by Michael Rawson and a 74-year-old man, Bill Williamson, was arrested for reading this poem, Don't Mention the Children. He was arrested in Scotland because of the effort to censor what genocide in Gaza in places like Great Britain and to some extent in America. Don't mention the children. Don't name the dead children. The people must not know the names of the dead children. The names of the children must be hidden. The children must be nameless. The children must leave this world having no names. No one must know the names of the dead children. No one must say the names of the dead children. No one must even think that the children have names. People must understand that it would be dangerous to know the names of the children. The people must be protected from knowing the names of the children. The names of the children could spread like wildfire. The people would not be safe if they knew the names of the children. Don't name the dead children. Don't remember the dead children. Don't think of the dead children. Don't say dead children. Michael Rawson. Oh, good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Good morning. Good to be with you again.
So, what's happening with the war in Iran and connected parties and regions?
Well, currently there seems to be another ceasefire. Heavy fighting resumed about 2 weeks ago. And Trump was getting frustrated that it didn't seem to be leading Iran to compromise further. So he was seriously considering just a few days ago greatly expanding the war to attack civilian infrastructure, including power plants and desalinization plants and the like. But it appears he was talked out of it by both his military advisors, but also by Arab Gulf allies, who point out that Iran would retaliate by attacking civilian infrastructure in these allied Gulf states, who are far more dependent on desalinization for their water and more vulnerable in terms of the electrical grid. And even though the United States and its allies have been successful at intercepting as much as 90% of Iranian projectiles, that 10% is enough to do a fair amount of damage. But also, crucially, these Iranian drones, you know, they cost maybe between $20,000 and $40,000 U.S. dollars. And whereas these interceptors, like the Patriot missiles, they cost about $4 million. And it's because the drone's a fairly simple technology, and the technologies to intercept missiles in flight is obviously more complicated. And similarly, drones are easy to produce quickly. These more complex systems take longer. And the United States was actually running out of these interceptors. And not just in terms of the Middle East, but they've been bringing them in from Europe and Asia and elsewhere, where they're a cornerstone of defensive positions for various U.S. bases and those of allies. And so you had these generals and others saying to Trump, hey, wait a minute, we're not going to be able to respond to a large-scale Iranian retaliation. Already, some missiles have gotten through. In fact, some U.S. commanders have allowed some missiles to get through because the ones that they think will do the least damage, because they need to save on the interceptors. So on a very practical, so not only was the war not working in terms of getting Iran to compromise and accede to U.S. demands, but strategically, we see that Iran has indeed perfected this new form of asymmetrical warfare, and it was very hard to counter, and escalation would just make things worse.
So, what's happening in the broader? What's happening in Lebanon and Hezbollah?
Yeah, well, Israel is occupying a large swath of southern Lebanon. They have turned over some small sectors of area, lands they seized, to the Lebanese army, and some of the close to 1 million refugees have started to return to their villages. In many cases, only finding that they have been destroyed. I mean, as with Gaza, Israel has been systematically blowing up homes and businesses and mosques and churches and all sorts of schools. And I mean, it's been a very much of a scorched earth policy.
Nobody seems to be noticing it.
It is in a remote area, and it's in a dangerous area. I've actually traveled there.
But people know it's happening, but they don't say anything about it. Much.
Right. I mean, again, we've long seen that countries that are allied with the West, you know, their atrocities are not, you know, quite given the attention that atrocities by adversarial regimes get. I mean, obviously, there have been human rights activists, and not just those focused on Palestine or Lebanon, but overall, who've been raising the alarm about Israeli war crimes. We know that the Israeli Prime Minister and the former Defense Minister have actually been indicted by the International Criminal Court for war crimes, and you know they've been well documented by Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, various UN agencies, other observers. But you know the Israelis know that with the protection of the United States through vetoes of otherwise unanimous UN Security Council resolutions trying to stop the fighting, the tens of billions of dollars of unconditional military aid the U.S. has provided Israel in these past few years, and many tens of thousands, millions of dollars, you know, prior to that, going back to the late 1960s, that they can pretty much get away with this kind of behavior.
How long will it take Trump to realize that the Iranians feel like they don't need to compromise anymore?
This is something that he's having a real hard time with. I mean, Trump, I think, has this idea that Iran's like some kind of, you know, what we used to call a banana republic, you know, small Caribbean islands or Central American nations, the kind that the United States has been able to effectively control for many decades. But Iran is a country of 90 million people. Formerly known as Persia, it's been a major regional power on and off for a good 2,500 years. They're not about to be pushed around. And And yes, the government is incredibly reactionary, incredibly repressive, you know, nasty as can be. But the U.S. attacks have actually consolidated the regime. People tend to rally around the flag when they are being bombed. And that's another thing that it appears that analysts were trying to advise the president that war plays right into the hands of the hardline military leaders and clerics in terms of getting people to support the regime. You know, people, it's very hard to dissent when your country is being attacked.
Well, is this going to continue until November, till the midterm elections?
At least. I mean, what I see is that basically, here's the problem, that because of Iran, you know, being able to demonstrate its power to close the Strait of Hormuz, essentially keep the world economy hostage. I mean, this is a clear violation of international law, but the Iranians figure, hey, the war attacking them was a violation of international law. So, you know, they if the U.S. is willing to run roughshod over these longstanding legal norms, you know, why should they feel obliged to abide by them themselves? But the problem is that whatever negotiated agreement comes regarding the Strait of Hormuz, Iran is going to assert at least some kind of control, some kind of influence. It's going to be very hard to go back to the freedom of navigation we had before. That would be a clear loss for the United States and much of the rest of the world. And similarly, they can take a harder line around their missiles, around their nuclear programming. Whatever deal they make around that will be more beneficial to Iran, less beneficial to the West than the 2015 nuclear agreement that signed by the United States, Iran, and five other countries, endorsed by the UN and the EU.
You mean the Obama agreement?
Yeah, exactly. The one that Trump insisted he tore up because he could get a better deal. Well, it's very obvious he is not going to be able to get a better deal. No one's going to get a better deal, and so he would essentially have to admit that he lost, and he does not want to, you know, look like a loser. I mean, he is willing to continue this war on and off, continue the death and destruction, continuing the damage it's doing to the global economy with the higher prices of petroleum, the shortages of fertilizer and liquid helium, and all the kinds of problems that they are having, the stagflation that's resulting. He's willing to sacrifice all that, and indeed probably sacrifice quite a few Republican seats in the November election, rather than bruise his ego by admitting that he launched a strategic blunder for the ages. I mean, this could very well be America's Suez, if for those of your listeners who recall the disastrous French and British invasion of Egypt in 1956, which was many people saw as sort of the death knell of their imperial ambitions. And we may be in a similar situation regarding the United States and its role in the world. But Trump doesn't want to admit that. He's willing to drag this on indefinitely. So what I see is that we're going to have periods of relative calm and some negotiations, perhaps some progress on a few things. They will break down eventually. One or both sides will relaunch attacks. We'll have a period of fighting, maybe another ceasefire, more negotiations. I mean, this could go on and on, you know, for many, many months. I mean, the thing about the 2015 deal negotiated by Obama and the others was that it was very, very detailed, left little room for ambiguity. But the memorandum of understanding that Iran and the United States signed a couple months ago, that's now kind of fallen apart, it was quite vague. And so both sides were trying to jockey to get a better position, to, you know, try to show that they, to pressure the other side to compromise. And so, you know, there was very little incentive to try to keep things calm. And this is why we're in this really difficult situation today.
What's been the effect on the world economy, particularly countries in Asia and the Pacific, such as Singapore or even New Zealand?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you folks are probably more more familiar with that than I am.
We don't have our own oil.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, obviously, petrol prices, I assume, are going up. And of course, petroleum is used in a whole lot of things, from plastics to fertilizer. Indeed, quite a bit of the world's fertilizer is produced in these Arab Gulf states that are not being able to get out to market. That means there's shortages in fertilizer. The prices have gone way up. Farmers are hurting, and food prices are going up. I mean, people are starving. This is increasing malnutrition, and all sorts of things. Liquid helium, 50% of the world's liquid helium comes through the Strait of Hormuz. That's used from everything from micro, processors to various medical. Procedures and the like. So it's
the politicians were telling us this would be over by April because they didn't want to face how serious it might get.
Oh yeah, no, exactly. It costs.
Well, it's past April.
Yeah. Well, very very much so, and. So not only is fertilizer more expensive, but the diesel for tractors and other farm equipment,
buses,
people, they other transit. Of course, all sorts of things are shipped by lorry or ships and other things that obviously their cost the transportation is costing more. I mean, if you and commercial fishermen, I mean, they are. In a tough spot as well, given the cost of fuel for their boats. So, I mean, on so many areas, this is having a serious problem. Now, there have been ways people have been trying to get around it. There's a pipeline that goes across Saudi Arabia out to the Red Sea. Saudi Arabia is the one country in that on the Arabian Peninsula that's big enough to have two coasts. But just this past week, the Houthis have started attacking Saudi ships. They have a narrow passageway at the bottom of the Red Sea that goes out to the Arabian Sea. Yemen's essentially closed that off. Most tankers are too big to go through the Suez Canal. It's a real mess. And the thing was, this is all completely predictable. I mean that. I mean, everybody I know who studies the region, would said that if the U.S. started a major war against Iran, they would close the Strait of Hormuz. If you Google my name, the Strait of Hormuz, you'll see articles that I've written going back 20, 25 years that predicted. Again, this was not this is no big surprise, but, Trump insists that he knows better than everybody else. His buddy Benjamin Netanyahu, convinced him that it would be, quick and easy, like in Venezuela, and the regime would fall, and Trump doesn't has never been one to listen to experts, whether it be on war or the economy or climate change or anything else.
Or should countries who believe in international rules? Based order and on institutions like the World Court and the UN try to oppose Trump directly, or would they try to appease him?
I mean, unfortunately, there are a lot of countries that, given the power of the United States and given how vindictive Trump has been in terms of imposing tariffs and all sorts of other things, have tried to make nice with him. But the United States really is acting as a rogue superpower at this point. I mean, this really does seem to warrant a far more aggressive approach. I mean, I think it's particularly important for middle powers like New Zealand, which, despite some failings, has generally been more supportive of international law, international legal institutions, and in a lot of countries. That, you know, this really is an important time to be willing to stand up to this, not just because it's morally right, not just because it's legally right, but for all the mentioned reasons we've been mentioning, it's causing a lot of problems to a lot of people throughout the world.
It seems to me that even if this ended tomorrow, the economy wouldn't necessarily recover tomorrow.
Well, not at all. I mean, the supply chains have been disrupted. Huge pile up of freighters and tankers in the Gulf. There's been a fair amount of physical damage to natural gas facilities and other things in a number of the Gulf states. Yeah, it's going to be it could be quite some time before things get back to normal. Though I should mention throw in one positive thing about this, and the one positive thing about this is that countries are recognizing that they cannot be dependent on imported oil. Because of how easy it could be disrupted. And orders for solar panels and windmills have dramatically increased. Factories in China have been running 24 hours a day producing solar panels and windmills. And throughout Asia and elsewhere, the demand for renewable, locally sourced energy is growing.
That's happening
and
in
so
Asia.
This
and
is maybe the one bright spot.
That's happening in Asia and the South Pacific, but apparently the New Zealand government isn't aware of the necessity to make this transformation.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a bit surprised. You know, New Zealand is a little behind on this issue, but certainly other countries are recognizing this this reality. And of course, we all, and for I'm sure your listeners realize that this is something we need to do anyway in terms of the planet and the threat of climate change. But it just seems to be, you know, common sense right now, you know, given the you know, ability to, you know, because of this these new drone technologies and the like, to you know, to disrupt you know, choke points in terms of maritime navigation. That is completely foolhardy to be dependent on imports of oil and natural gas and the like when you can have safe, renewable, locally based energy within your own country.
One thing that still surprises me is the fact that when Iran was attacked during negotiations, that so few countries actually condemned America and Israel for the attack on Iran.
Yeah, and part of it, I think, is again the fear of U.S. retaliation. But I think we need to acknowledge the nature of the Iranian regime. You know, just weeks before, they had massacred many thousands of their own citizens who were protesting, overwhelmingly nonviolent. For greater freedom and democracy, and into the corruption, and you know, Iran in many ways had never been more isolated, and I think, you know, Trump mistakenly believed that because of this, and because some of Iran's allies like Hezbollah and Hamas and were weakened, there were one. The one national government that they were allied with, Syria under Assad, had been overthrown. The Houthis had been weakened as well. That the U.S. could take advantage of that, but the Iranians were able to, but in many ways, just ended up consolidating the regime. The killing of Ayatollah Khamenei led to his son, who is even at least as hardline, becoming the leader. I mean, the senior Khamenei was everybody assumed was going to die within a year or two. He was quite old and in failing health, and there were those who were hopeful that a number of the more moderate candidates might then succeed him. But because of the killing there, people thought it was time to have a more hardline leader. And so again, this has totally backfired in terms of if the goal was to try to encourage reform within the Iranian system. And it's also, for reasons I mentioned before, held set back efforts of more radical changes as well.
What's happening in Palestine and the Gaza and the West Bank? What's happening now? Is the killing stopped? Are things improved or what?
Well, there are periodic airstrikes by Israel in violation of the ceasefire. Nothing close to the wholesale slaughter we saw for 2.5 years. But Israel has been encroaching in its occupied parts of Gaza Strip. Close to 70% of Gaza Strip is under Israeli occupation, and they have pretty much systematically razed every building. I mean, it's just rubble. It is just horrific. The population is then crowded into the remaining 30%. Hamas is still in control. Their thugs are still running things and with the power of the gun. There's still not enough food and medicine getting in. The international reporters are still banned. And meanwhile, Trump's so-called Board of Peace, is talking about setting up a little enclave of high tech and other kind of investments, but it's hard to imagine that going very far. They're not including any representative Palestinians. Obviously, it would be important to remove Hamas, but they're rolling out allowing the Palestinian government based in Ramallah in the West Bank, which is the recognized Palestinian government, which Hamas rebelled against, to run Palestine, because the U.S. doesn't want a Palestinian state, even a tiny mini state. They basically support continued Israeli colonization. We're seeing this in the West Bank, where these settler militia, backed directly by the Israeli army, have engaged in a reign of terror. In many ways, it's reminiscent of the death squads we saw in Central America and elsewhere in Latin America during the 1980s. They have been killing hundreds of Palestinians, unarmed Palestinians. They have been burning vineyards and orchards and other cropland. They have been destroying homes. People have been fleeing, and again, the U.S. administration and a majority of Congress continue to give the Israelis a blank check to continue this. And since we mentioned Palestine and Lebanon, we should also mention Syria. Several months ago, Israel broke off the 1974 disengagement agreement that was negotiated by Henry Kissinger, and they have seized even more land in Syria beyond the occupied Golan Heights. Israel annexed the Golan in 1981. There was a unanimous UN Security Council resolution, even supported by the Reagan administration, that declared it null and void and reiterated the inadmissibility of expanding territory by force. Under Trump's first term, the United States became the first country to formally recognize the Gaza Strip. Formally recognize the Golan Heights as part of Israel. And the Biden administration upheld that recognition. This week, we have Secretary General of the United Nations in Syria. He has reiterated that the Golan does belong to Syria, that changing international boundaries by force is illegitimate. It's illegitimate when Russia has done it, does in Ukraine and Morocco and Western Sahara, but also Israel and Syria.
Israel isn't going to stop, is it, unless there's unless either military aid stops or economic boycott becomes so severe that they have to stop.
Yeah, I mean, how about
the American people? Do they support all this?
Well, there's been a dramatic shift in U.S. public opinion in the past couple of years. Now, for the first time, a pretty solid majority of Americans sympathize more with the Palestinians than with Israel. And also for the first time, a sizable majority, including close to 80% of registered Democrats, oppose additional military aid to Israel. This hasn't impacted the Trump administration or the Republican Party, and the leadership of the Democratic Party. I mean, Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader in the Senate, Hakeem Jeffries, the Democratic leader in the House, and still firmly support unconditional military aid to Israel. The official position of the Democratic Party is that aid to Israel is ironclad, should not be changed. But we're finding increasing number of House and Senate Democrats, especially those who are up for re-election, are recognizing that this is not a popular position. And quite a few now have rejected getting support from AIPAC, the powerful pro-Israel group. They for the first time, slightly over half of the Democrats in the House went on record opposing Trump's latest arms package. And the matter it passed anyway because it had near unanimous Republican support and nearly half of the Democrats' support. But it shows there really is a shift going on. Now, I've seen this before, with Vietnam, with Central America, with apartheid South Africa, with the Gulf War, with the Iraq War, the nuclear arms race and things like, and other controversial foreign policies where the Democratic Party has taken hawkish positions. Eventually the American public has come around, particularly within the Democratic sphere, and they have been able to pressure a change. But there's often a lag time. I mean, the majority of Americans opposed the Vietnam War as far back as 1967, but we didn't pull out until 1973. I think we really are starting to see a fundamental shift in public opinion. But again, it's going to be a while before change in policy.
Democratic nominations for Congress?
It's certainly an issue in a number of congressional races. Indeed, there were recent primaries in New York and Colorado and elsewhere. We had insurgent Democrats that actually defeated incumbents in the primary, and they used the incumbents' support for Israel as a major focus of their campaign. And so I think we really are seeing a shift. I mean, in New York City, which has the largest Jewish population of any city in the world, they elected a Muslim mayor who is strongly anti-Zionist and has called for the arrest of Netanyahu as a war criminal, has been very, very forthcoming in his opposition. And what we're seeing, especially among young people, including young Jews, including most young American Jews, do not identify as Zionists anymore. They're becoming more and more critical of Israel. There's been a huge generational shift here. So, again, we're seeing some very dramatic changes in domestic American politics regarding Israel and Palestine.
Mondera, the mayor of New York, apparently is not only takes a stand on Israel and Zionism, but also is trying to make New York fairer, more equal, more affordable.
Being able to
rent houses. They put a stop on raising rents in New York.
Zoran Mamdani calls himself a democratic socialist. And he is pushing a very very progressive agenda.
Apparently people in New York like him for it.
Yeah, he's quite
still popular.
Popular
even after getting elected.
Oh yeah,
that's
yeah,
when you lose your popularity usually.
No, he's a very smart a political figure. He's quite young. He's only 33 years old, has really changed the dynamic of a city that has often been dominated by machine politics and old guard. We're seeing the local Democratic parties in the boroughs of New York, like in Manhattan and Brooklyn, that are being transformed by a young progressive activist. I mean, I think what we're starting to see a trend, especially in more progressive urban areas, but in a broader area as well, that even as the Republican Party has gotten scarily far to the right and authoritarian and more overtly racist and resembles the far right parties in Europe rather than the more traditional conservatism of American Republicans. But on the Democratic side, the Democrats are moving more and more in a social democratic direction, more and more to the left. The Democrats party has traditionally been more like the liberal centrist parties in Europe, and they are moving more, I guess I say, in a more social democratic direction. So there is a quite a an exciting realignment in certain ways in party politics. I mean, this polarization can be scary, but it can also lead to a lot of opportunities. I mean, we think of other times there's been polarization, like the 1930s. Well, 1930s, you got fascism in Spain and Italy and Germany, but you also had the social democratic revolutions in Scandinavia and the New Deal in the United States. Similarly, if you look at the late 60s, early 70s, you had these horrific, fascistic right-wing military regimes in Latin America and in much of the other parts of the global South. But you also had, of course, the dramatic changes in terms of equality for women, for people of color, for queer people, for so many other things, all the great progressive movements of that era. So we're in a similar area of polarization. We could go either way. We could go fascist.
You want to Maine.
In a more progressive direction as well.
Because Maine's a rural state in the far northeast of America. Can you talk about that a bit?
I'm sorry, the what?
Maine.
Maine, yes. Yeah, Maine is a rural state in the far northeastern corner. In many ways, it has an economy not unlike the global South, based on tourism and on extractive industries. And it has traditionally been, a place with more moderate Republicans and more centrist Democrats. But their Senate nominee, they had two Senate nominees. One was forced out because of some serious allegations of rape and other improprieties. He denies the rape charge, but he acknowledges some other behavior that was a result of his alcoholism coming back from Iraq as a soldier with a post-traumatic stress disorder and the like. But he was a oyster man. He's been replaced by another working class Maine activist who served for leadership in the state legislature.
He was a logger.
He's a logger, by trade. And so we are starting to see this interesting trend of this kind of left-wing working-class populism, that you often associate with Britain or some European countries. That has given a lot of excitement and energy in the race there against the incumbent Republican senator, who's been there for many, many decades. And on certain level measures, she's one of the more moderate Republicans in the Senate right now. But she's generally, when push comes to shove, she's often ended up being the decisive vote in Trump's favor. So she's not being very popular at the moment.
So is this a foretaste of what may come?
I really do think so. I mean, this is a very exciting time to be in the United States. Politically, they have this battle within the Democratic Party, traditional centrists and liberals, and this more progressive socialist current. For the first time, the majority of registered Democrats have a more positive view of socialism than they do of capitalism. And we're starting to see that reflected. Much more critical view of the U.S. role in the world, about the enormous amount of money we spend on our military while having inadequate infrastructure, healthcare, education, housing, public transit, and everything else. But the level of authoritarianism of Trump running roughshod over basically constitutional principles and the way the Republican majority in Congress has allowed him to get away with it, it is a really scary time. It raises questions about how fair the November elections might be, and the courts are largely Bush and Trump appointees, very right wing, and have been willing to allow Trump to get away with a lot of things that previous courts would not have allowed. So we are in a situation comparable to Hungary under Orban, Modi in India today, other cases where we've had these right-wing leaders taking advantage of their positions to try to reshape society in a much more authoritarian way.
Could you talk about Project 2025 and its effect on the Republican Party?
Well, this is basically an effort by a right-wing think tank and folks to basically reorder America in a more a plutocratic, authoritarian direction. They basically argued that you cannot trust the people, that there's such a thing as too much democracy, that we need to have a very strong centralized state with a white male leadership to challenge the more diverse society that the United States has been becoming, and to basically undermine the environmental laws, the social welfare programs, basically much of the role that government has in providing the general welfare, and concentrating it in terms of a national security state. And again, I think of analogies with Latin America in the 70s and 80s, and what we saw in places like Brazil and Argentina and Uruguay and Chile. This is not just the whims of Donald Trump. This is a project that seems to have fairly widespread support among corporate leaders and Republican members of Congress and the right-wing think tanks and others. And they have been able to manipulate opinion, especially among less educated white working-class people, about the fears of that white men who've kind of lost their privileged positions through the attacks on immigrants, on people of color, on queer people, particularly trans people, to basically try to portray the Democrats and especially the more progressive wing of the party as communists who are trying to take over. I mean, Trump himself, in a recent speech, just went on and on about how the Democratic Party is communist and the communists are taking over. I mean, this is almost 1950s type rhetoric claiming that there's no difference between social democracy and a Marxist-Leninist dictatorship.
Do people like Bernie Sanders, can they respond to this? Because we actually, the people you were talking about actually have suffered a lot in the north, mm-hmm. the northeast of the United States. The demography, people dying younger in the north, places like Ohio yeah. and Michigan. That's
yeah, so the yeah, decline in health care. The
employment.
Issues that, unemployment, jobs.
Almost anything you could name has gone downhill for them.
Right. It is. The United States in many ways is, in terms of the level of economic inequality, and the breakdown of democratic institutions, the deteriorating infrastructure, elimination of consumer protection laws, environmental laws, worker health and safety laws. The selling off of national park land to developers. I mean, you go down the list. We are looking at more and more like what we used to call a third world nation.
And you can't.
Really, and it's been. It's really quite.
You can't deal with it like Clinton did by calling these people deplorables. You actually need a program to reverse inequality, don't you?
That's the big battle in the Democratic Party. Here's the big part. I mean that the new Democratic Party, starting under Bill Clinton as president, went in a very neoliberal direction. And that, and we've seen this in a number of places, including New Zealand to some degree. When the left party, goes neoliberal, and people start losing their jobs and their benefits and things like that, they are tempted to identify be susceptible to appeals by right wing, populism. That they suddenly are depicted as the establishment. This is why if Bernie Sanders had gotten the nomination instead of Hillary Clinton in 2016, he would almost certainly beaten Trump, because Trump picked up white working class support, because the neoliberal policies had led to greater unemployment among factory workers and the like, the policies that Hillary Clinton supported, that it was the wars that Hillary Clinton supported, like Iraq and Afghanistan, that sent their kids off to fight, to die, to come back mentally and physically broken. But Bernie Sanders opposed neoliberal policies. He opposed these wars. But since he was denied the nomination, in part because of the machinations of the Democratic National Committee, Trump was able to say, I'm the populist. I'm the one who'll stick up for working class Americans. I won't send your kids off to die in these overseas forever wars like Hillary Clinton. I'll bring jobs back and the like. And so in a big mistake we've seen repeatedly is Democrats thinking, being more centrist will make us more appealing to swing voters. I mean, Kamala Harris, her big mistake was she got the endorsements of a lot of Republicans, including Dick Cheney, Liz Cheney, other Republicans, saying, "Hey, I'm a big bipartisan middle of the road moderate tent," but that just played into Trump's hands, saying, "Well, the establishment of both parties are against me, and I'm for the people." And if instead she had moved left, and really talked about these bread and butter issues, the way that working class people are being screwed by Trump's pro-corporate agenda, and cutting back on all these programs that helped people that had parents or kids that needed medical attention or home health care or whatever that would have made health care more affordable, that could have made rent more affordable. She could have won people over like that. And so we're seeing this in the Democratic Party and the various primaries that have been taking place the past few months. We have a few more coming up in the coming weeks. And it's very much a battle between those who say being centrist and being moderate is the way to win, those versus those saying the only way to fight right-wing populism is left-wing populism. And so that's really what we're seeing unfolding right now.
What's your forecast for the midterm elections? First, will the Democrats likely to do well, and will they be fair election, not corrupted by the president?
A free and fair election, I think the Democrats are going to win overwhelmingly. I think there's a strong motivation on the Democratic side. A lot of Trump's base are increasingly alienated by the corruption and the authoritarian moves and the economy, which wasn't great even before the Iran war, in a worse situation because of it. But there have been a lot of efforts by the administration to try to limit voting. For example, they have several states, a number of states have redrawn congressional maps to make it so that it's very hard for Democrats to win. Like in a state where it might be 50-50, but Democratic and Republican, the way they've drawn the districts is it could be like 80% Republican. And we've seen this in a whole number of places.
What will the reaction of the country if it's seen clearly either that the elections have been corrupted, as we're talking about?
Well, it depends. I mean, if it's just by gerrymandering about the districts where, say, the Democrats win 55 or 60% of the vote, but get only 48% of the seats, and the Republicans end up winning, I mean, that would be frustrating, but I don't think people would do much about it. What would be more serious if we see a situation, as we've seen in a number of countries, where the president declares an emergency, troops come in, they seize the ballots, corrupt state officials will not count a whole bunch of votes by using false claims of fraud. There are a number of scenarios like this. If it's clearly stolen in that that votes aren't counted. one could certainly see a kind of perhaps an uprising similar to what we saw in the Philippines and Serbia and Gambia and a number of other countries where there were similar attempts to try to steal an election. Another thing that Trump's really pushing is to make it so that you cannot you're not allowed to vote unless you have both a photo ID and proof of citizenship. This is a problem because there are a lot of Americans who don't have a photo ID. We don't have a national ID card. Not everybody has a driver's license. But proof of citizenship. Most Americans don't have a passport. Most people have either lost their passport or it's in a file somewhere. They don't know, their birth certificate. They don't know where they filed it or whatever. I mean, there are ways that, and there are other ways that, requirements where people will make it harder, particularly for Democratic-leaning voters. In several places, states have deliberately moved voting places, areas, away from college and university campuses that tend to vote a Democratic, making it harder for students, most of whom do not have cars, to be able to make it to the polling place. Or they'll do something mm-hmm. like make much more polling places available in more conservative mm-hmm. white suburban areas, but only have a handful of places in the poor urban areas for people of color, so you have to stand in line for hours. Okay. Now, some states have even passed laws that say it's a crime to pass out water to people who are waiting in line to vote. and things like that. You know, so there's a lot of this kind of thing going on.
Okay, we've got about 3 minutes, 2 or 3 minutes. Do you think the Democratic Party is going to learn its lesson and become a social democratic party?
I think it's
inevitably.
It may there be elements in the party that are going to be kicking and screaming. They're going to be, you know, pundits, newspaper columnists,
and the
people on the cable news that are going to say, you know, oh, we're caught between the two extremes, as if there's an equivalent between Trump and social Democrats. The funding, you know, funders will withhold money, and you know, thanks to the Supreme Court, there are virtually no limits now on campaign financing. So Republicans get a lot more money than the Democrats do. But I think if you look at the demographics, the fact that young people are overwhelmingly to the left of people of the older generation, and that, you know, this is the future. And yeah, we have a stereotype when people get older, they have more.
Okay, so
really,
then,
not really. I think it's going to be.
This is a good
really
way to end. This is the future. The future, if we have a socialism or barbarism. So the future, if we're lucky, is social democracy.
Exactly.
Okay, thanks a lot.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.